Hello and welcome to the Albion Obsessed podcast. You join us for our first defeat of the season at the hands of West Ham, who get their first victory over Brighton in 13 attempts. And to join us in this trip down a rather painful memory lane is Joe. Joe, my friend, how are you?
Do you know what, Tom? Let's start today with some positivity. I got my shirts, well, one shirt printed yesterday, and I got this guy on the back. For the audio listeners, Purvis Estupiñán on the back of the shirt, the home shirt this year. Got the Europa League badges. We're very happy with that. So I thought I'd start off with a little bit of positivity. But other than that, I really don't want to be here, Tom. Moving on.
Well, that's just rude. Dagan, welcome to the podcast today. How are you feeling as our resident optimist?
Angry. I'm happy to be here. I'm not happy to be discussing this particular catastrophic result. The sky's falling. We're getting relegated. All the things that people say, right, are happening. We'll get into it. But as usual, I think there's context, and I hope we can be helpful in teasing some of that out.
That's a very good point here, Dagan, because that's what we're here to do. And to join us in getting that context is also Sony. Sony, how are you doing?
I'm still in my pajamas. It's Sunday morning. I'm tired. The dog is here chilling with me because he's also tired. So we're both going to be talking about yesterday's interesting game together. Because what happened, bro? What happened?
We're here to talk about what happened. And let's start at the beginning. Let's start at the starting 11, Joe, as we always like to on the podcast. Two changes from the side that beat Wolves. And the big one was in Sticks, where Bart Verbruggen gets his first start at the expense of Jason Steele. Now, Roberto De Zerbi did say he would interchange between Steele and Verbruggen because, in his words, he has two number ones at the club. What did you make of Big Bart getting his first start?
I think when you're bought in for a fee, not a massive fee, obviously, but when you're bought in for a substantial fee, you expect to be playing games. And I think he's got a fantastic attitude from what I've seen and from what I've heard him say about Roberto De Zerbi and about how he wants to fight for his place and how he respects Jason Steele and what he'd done last season. I thought it was probably about time that we saw him. I don't think it's any slander on Jason Steele, the fact that he's been dropped. I think Steele would have taken that well. And the goalkeepers union is rocking. And I was happy to see Verbruggen in the Sticks because I feel like he, obviously we haven't seen him earn it per se, but I feel like he should be in there at some point. And it was good to see him given the nod.
Yeah, it's just a shame, really, that he came in for such a game because I don't think we can fault him for anything that happened yesterday, but more on that a little bit later. And Dagan, the other change made to the starting 11 was an enforced change in that Julian Ciso, unfortunately injured, looks to be out for the rest of the calendar year, obviously not in the squad, and in came Evan Ferguson. So Evan Ferguson, Dagan, with his first start. Evan Ferguson is often tipped by many as our best striker at the club. Were you surprised it took almost, three games for him to get his first start of the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys know my position on this subject. It's not that I'm not a Welbeck fan. I think Welbeck is best coming on when we have a lead or when the defense, at the very least, is tired. Having the two of them there, I just didn't think Welbeck was a threat. Ferguson belonged, but he had trouble finding space. I think in games like this, the reason Ferguson is such an asset is because he's our one guy who can really elevate in the box and get his head on the ball, which he did a couple of times. He just didn't quite get enough to finish. I could talk at length about that. The City game is fresh in my mind. And in a lot of ways, the City game today was a lot like our game yesterday. The difference being they broke through from being very, very patient and deliberate and eventually getting the ball up in the air and Haaland, skying to win it and putting it in the net. And yeah, the absent player, similar to City, Sheffield drew, pulled back even, and they brought on Foden, who had, I think many folks would have been like, why is he sitting? He's their creator. And immediately, within like 2 minutes of coming on, he got an assist. And I thought about, João Pedro yesterday, if he's entering a tie game as opposed to one where we're trailing, he's a different player. And so, for me, that's the one of the first places we went wrong. It's a long answer about the change in the starting lineup, but I think it was an important one. And I think, for a game where we needed to be able to penetrate what was going to be a packed defense, even when it was an even game, and certainly became one once they had a lead, I feel like we needed João Pedro instead of Welbeck out there with Ferguson.
Yeah, talking of which, Sonny, I mean, with Enciso's unfortunate injury, João Pedro almost became the shoe-in to start, but he didn't. Were you surprised at João Pedro's admission to the starting 11?
Yeah, actually. I mean, he's been, good on the field. We like his style of play. We like how he's building in with the team. I'm really surprised at, granted, it's only, the first three games of the season so far. Just changing it up a little bit or giving some people like a start time or something just to kind of see their place in the lineup throughout the year. I don't like questioning De Zerbi because I know he has plans in mind and he likes to change it dynamically. It's always like a Russian roulette type deal. But I wonder what was going through his head this week when he decided to not put him on, because that just, I don't know.
Yeah, I think we'll dive into it as we analyze the game. But last thing, Joe, just on the starting 11 on the bench, I just want to mention very briefly Facundo Buonanotte. It looked almost sure that he'd be going out on loan. He said he wants to stay and fight for his place. And with Enciso, as we say, unfortunately injured. And of course, we wish Enciso a very speedy recovery. But some fantastic mentality from Facundo to say, no, he wants to stay and fight for his place. And this is an ample opportunity, I should say, to do it.
Yeah. And I think Roberto De Zerbi will respect the fact that he wants to stay and fight for his position. And given the circumstances, obviously really bad circumstances for him to be given sort of a elevation into the starting 11, not starting 11, sorry, into the 20, if you like, because it's sort of 20 players now, isn't it? 9 on the bench. That he would sort of feel like, okay, now's my chance to really start to show what I can do and force my way, whether that be off the bench and show what I can do or prove to him in training that I'm worthy of taking Enciso's starting place. I don't think we saw enough of him last season in the role that we would like him to be in. I think he was utilised when Solly March was injured mostly, which was a shame because obviously he struggled in that position. He's a young guy adapting to the Premier League. But yeah, now's his chance. And I really, really hope for him that he takes that chance because that we've seen flashes of what he can do. And there's definitely a player in there. It's just whether, and I think I trust anyone, I trust De Zerbi to get the most out of Facundo Buonanotte.
Yeah, no, I'm inclined to agree there. And it's just, as I say, really nice mentality to show a young player that he's willing to fight for his place. And we saw glimpses of it in the US series, his willingness to track back and his, tenacity. So good signs are there that he will become a very useful player. And let's hope that he can get some minutes under his belt sooner rather than later. I've tried to prolong it as much as I can, but I'm afraid now we're going to have to talk about the game. Dagan, the signs were there from the get-go, really. I mean, in the first opening 10 minutes, West Ham had a few chances. Zouma headed on Kofal's long throw. Paqueta, he fired over on the angle. Antonio got a shot away. So the early warning signs were there, but West Ham weren't just going to be here content for a point or to just roll over for a Brighton team that were, at the time, top of the table. Were you concerned in those opening 10 minutes that it could perhaps be a tougher challenge than many predicted?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chelsea game for West Ham provided a nice template for this one. You know, they aren't taking a lot of chances, and they're trying to make the most of the ones they get. You know, it felt like one of those games, and I think, you know, we talked about it maybe last week. If we don't score first against a team like this, we're in a lot of trouble. It just is what it is. I mean, I think, you know, we had, after that initial run, there was a period of play where we looked more in control before they got a goal. And, you know, I think it was Gilmore fired a shot that just went wide. And if that shot goes in, my 4-1 prediction for this game in our favor maybe comes true. You know, even Moyes said, you know, if you play this game a number of times again, they may not win it. But it did end up looking like they were in total control because they made the most of their chances. And we can talk more about the errors that led to that tremendous amount of XG and eventually goals as well.
Yes, unfortunately, we will have to talk about that. And again, sooner rather than later. Just very briefly, Sonny, you know, Dagan's touched on it there. They're, after the first 10 minutes, which admittedly was all West Ham, Brighton did start coming into the game a bit. They turned the tide. They were moving the ball pretty well, making West Ham work quite hard. And Gilmore having the first sort of half chance, really, fizzing a shot just wide after a great pass from Pascal Gross. So signs were starting to, you know, they were there that Brighton was starting to move and go through the gears. So that was, in and of itself, a positive response to West Ham's early pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad that we finally got our shit together. Sorry, our stuff together. But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's like, we should have been doing this from the get-go. I don't know why we were just like, all right, let's mess around with them. No, you have, like RDZ says, you have to keep the same mentality throughout the 90 minutes. You cannot let off the pressure. If you let off the pressure because you think, oh, I'm going to beat this team, like, easily, no big deal. It's like a cat swatting its, like, toys or whatever. Like, it's going to play with it before it decides to, you know, attack it or whatever. We can't keep doing that. And I have a feeling that we have been doing that a lot. And that's why we keep scoring towards, like, at least the second half or the very end. It's like, we should have been doing this from the get-go. What are we doing?
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, you look at Luton, you look at Wolves. We had, you know, we started quite slow in them games, and we started slow yesterday. And I think it's fair to say that West Ham were probably our biggest test so far this season. A lot of people, when they looked at the fixtures, thought the biggest test would be Newcastle after West Ham's disappointing season last season in the league. At least everyone looked at the Newcastle game as being the first real big test. But, you know, credit to West Ham because they set up their game plan very well, because, you know, once Brighton started getting in the ascendancy, you know, the statistics, the passing, the possession was, you know, hugely in Brighton's favour. I mean, within the first 20 minutes, Brighton had completed something like, I don't know, quite a large number of passes, and West Ham had done like 12. But at the end of the day, those stats, unfortunately, couldn't stop Joe. A goal which was at the time against the run of play, and it all comes down to two individual errors by Adam Webster. First of all, a loose pass gets intercepted by James Ward-Prowse, and then Webster doesn't clear his lines and gets out-muscled by Antonio, who then puts the ball in the box. And, you know, it's a bit of a clam. I don't know if it's Gilmore not getting in front of Ward-Prowse, I don't know. But either way, Ward-Prowse tucks in. Really unfortunate goal to concede.
Trying to talk about unfortunate. I think annoying. Really, really annoying. Given that when you're under that pressure as a centre-back and you don't really know who's behind you to cover, stick it in the stands. Just hoof it up to the west stand as high as you can. I don't care, and then reset, and then most likely we get the ball clear from the throw on and we're okay again. But now suddenly we're on the back foot because Webster can't make up his mind as to what he wants to do. In the stands, I actually thought that he'd made the back pass because I saw Verbruggen sort of advancing towards it, but then he decided, actually, no, I can't get there, and then started to backtrack. So I actually started to clap him, and then I saw what he'd done. And I was like, oh, no. Oh no! And then, as soon as you see James Ward-Prowse approaching, granted he had to have sort of two attempts at it, but it was always going to happen when we got Gilmore scrambling, and we can't keep asking Estupiñán to keep covering that the other defenders bums, if you like, really, because I think it was before that goal that Estupiñán covered really, really well, coming across to basically mop up the whole back line. And it was incredible to see that. And I'm sorry if this is jumping forward, Tom, to one of your other points, but imagine having an Estupiñán type fullback on the other side. Imagine that.
That's literally what we're about to talk about next, Joe, because I said it in the group chat last night. Some people disagree with me. I've said it on our Telegram in Seagulls Worldwide chat, and some people have disagreed, as is their prerogative. You know, the world will be boring if we all had the same opinions. But Dagan, we need a right back. I mean, in those frames, watching it on the TV, Pascal Gross and James Milner are nowhere to be seen. And again, jumping forward, I mean, Moyes did so well, you know, and when we watched that back on our match of the day analysis, they exploited that right-hand side because Webster was being drawn out of position because there was just nobody in that right-back spot. And with Moises Caicedo gone, who's also there to mop up, how, watching that game yesterday, how convinced are you of the importance of getting a right-back in?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, is it second to getting a Caicedo-like player in? Sure. But I do think there's a need. And I think, yes, you know, dreamland, we have a healthy Lamptey and Veltman, you know, as a combo, depending upon sort of the physicality versus the speed of the player on that side, maybe. And you could trade those two guys off if you could imagine they were going to be fit. And you can imagine Veltman wouldn't be needed in the center back rotation because Webster was going to play the way he played yesterday. I mean, we can't, I know there's more to talk about and more goals, but it was poor. And I think juxtaposed with the City game today, these games are so similar. And Webster's, the first goal was a forced ball that he didn't need to send, a pass that he telegraphed, that James Ward-Prowse sat on, that he shot the passing lane on, and then beat all of our guys down the pitch. James Ward-Prowse, not a speedster, right? Just, he outworked everybody, Milner trotting back, Gross trotting back, and he ended up solo with Gilmore, who's not the biggest, strongest guy, and who kind of just nudged him off enough. And Gilmore was late coming and made a hard charge. But, you know, everything that happened, Webster, you know, had a chance to win the ball back pretty easily and gave it back to Antonio. I mean, yeah, the question is about right back. There's so many dominoes that fall and holes and weaknesses that are becoming apparent because guys are having to track back and cover. You know, a part of the issue, you know, on the second goal, and it was eerily similar to the second goal last year against Everton, where Webster is rotating over and he doesn't close all the way out because he's trying to contain and not get blown by. And so they float across an easy cross because there's no pressure on the ball. You know, but again, that's a part of, well, there's no right back that's coming to help, and the added pressure on Webster in that situation where he's pinned back there, there's no right back coming to help. It's those guys are fine until they're not. And by those guys, I mean Milner and Gross. And it's like, oh, they're great. When we're clicking and we're humming and we're in possession and they're just distributing, it looks awesome. When we're sitting back and we're in good position and they're just, you know, defending smartly most of the time, fine. But in those transitions where we're the weakest and most vulnerable, it's not fine. It's bad. It's poor. And you better have somebody to make up for them. And again, Caicedo was a guy who could do that a lot of the time. And maybe Baleba will be too, or Baleba. Right now it's a thorn in our side, and it's one that I feel like we should have been aware of going into this game. I would have much rather seen some different guys out there. I hope we see Veltman at right back next game, because I think the physicality and pace of Newcastle in combination is going to be a real problem. And if they score first, it won't be 3-1. It may be 5-1 or 6-1, because they are potent.
They certainly are. We will, of course, talk that at the end of the show. But no, some really good points there, Dagan. I mean, anything to add on that, Sony? I mean, we've seen in the last couple of games, I mean, Wolves and Luton, to their credit, you know, they have given us problems of sorts. But yesterday we came up against a team that were, you know, as Dagan says, on the back of a 3-1 win against Chelsea, you know, high on confidence. And, you know, they utilised the space and the holes that were within our squad. I mean, it's hard to, you know, it seems unfair, I suppose, to point the finger solely at Adam Webster. But when mistakes like that happen, it's hard not to. What was your view on the first goal?
I mean, At first, I kind of looked at it and was like, maybe it's Verbruggen. Maybe it's he was out of place or something. But when they were doing the replays over and over again, I'm like, wait, it's not his fault. Like, he literally was doing what he was supposed to do. He was covering as much as he could. But again, when your people are out of place, it's going to go in. And we weren't in place. We definitely had a lot of holes. We definitely had a lot of issues. And poor Bart, honestly, like, poor Bart, like, that is probably not a good game to start your, you know, your goaltending career with. That's bad. And I'm going to speak about the goalies here right now, since I have the opportunity to. I was also expecting Verbruggen to start this week, because as RDZ mentioned, it's a 50-50 split. Both of those guys are doing extremely well. So we had Jason Steele, who did the first two games, and everyone I know was like, or are we not letting Bart play? Why are we not letting him go there? Why is Steele playing? First off, you're not going to give the person who just got into the Premier League the first game of the season. That's already just asking for trouble, right? You want to set the tone. And so my theory has always been, and always will be, the fact that Jason Steele took the first two games to kind of set the tone, to give Bart like a preview of what he does in an actual Premier League counting setting, and just not put a lot of pressure on him the first two games, right? Now that we're in game three, now that we're starting to, you know, inch towards, hey, Europa League, hey, cup games, hey, this, that, and the other, we want to make sure that our newest goalie is prepped for that. And clearly he was ready for all sorts of outcomes. But not only the first goal, but the other two goals that we will talk about later on in the game, it's like, they weren't supporting him. You know what West Ham was doing? Supporting their goalie. Like, that dude was over here blocking saves like crazy. And of course, we'll discuss those later on down the road as well. But I mean, I could just see him just, you know, making the effort, his team, like, helping him out with making sure that those passes were blocked, you know, just trying to do as much as they could. And you could tell that, like, that guy was putting in work. So shout out to Areola, because that was a masterclass. I know some people, and I know some people in the group chat as well, were discussing, like, oh, it was just for the TV or whatnot. But hey, every save is a save. I saw it and I said, okay, great. That guy is doing work. So I can't really complain. But no, again, it's all about just making sure that you're in the right place at the right time. And if you're not in the right place, you're going to have mistakes like this, and they're going to keep going if you don't fix it.
Yeah. And unfortunately we saw that throughout the game. Joe, just really quickly, I mean, Sony touched upon it there, about West Ham's defensive structure and their defensive shape. And it was just so telling that after going a goal up, they would just sit back, 11 men behind the ball, deep block, because they wanted to make it hard for Brighton to play. And as great as RDZ has been for Brighton, it still becomes a bit of a thorn in our side that when we come up against these teams with a low block, it becomes very hard to break them down. What did you make of West Ham's tactics in the game?
I think you've got to give credit to David Moyes. You have to give credit to the fact that they came to the Amex at the tail end of last season and got absolutely thumped. And that was because they let us play freely. That's because they wanted to play their game and it didn't work. And then he's gone away. They've won a European Cup. They've come into this season with a spring in their step, which you would expect. And they've thought, you know what? Actually, if we utilise our strengths as what we can do against Brighton and give the low block, that works so effectively well against them, and use our power and pace going forward, Jared Bowen, Antonio, Lucas, Paqueta, then we're going to hurt them. You see what Everton did, and it's no disrespect to Everton, but they're not fire starters. They're not incredible, and they're not an incredible team. And they absolutely rinsed us using the same tactic. So David Moyes has done his homework. He's seen what works against Brighton, and he's played an absolute blinder. Obviously, Roberto De Zerbi wants us to stick to what we know and what we love about this Brighton team, and how we kept plugging away. And I absolutely have to give credit to the team. As much as we're berating them, as much as we're saying, oh, it was such a crap performance, there were so many individual errors, which there were, I'm not denying that, but we did not stop. And I understand that we were a bit slow, we were a bit rigid, there wasn't enough movement going forwards, but we were still creating chances. The moment I worry is the moment we're not creating these chances, the moments we're not in these games that we could be winning. I'm not going to say should be winning, because we're not entitled to win every single Premier League game. This game, we could have won it. And David Moyes said as much himself. So you have to give credit to them for playing an absolute blinder. And I'm going to give credit to our players for not giving up, because we did have ample chances towards the end to tie the game. Credit goes to them, I guess.
I think you're spot on, Joe, because I think you might look at the scoreline and you think, oh yeah, Brighton played really badly, but I don't necessarily think we did. I think in the first half, it was quite slow. And then we put things right in the second half, which we'll get onto in just a moment. But as I say, that first half, I think we ended it with 84% possession. As soon as they scored, we had a chance to equalise. Ferguson on the turn, Areola saves. So we did have our chances, and West Ham were just so good, as Sony says, at staying very, very compact. And whenever they got forward, and this was, you could see this in the second half, it was a brilliant, I say brilliant, it wasn't brilliant for us, it was brilliant for them. I think they had had a corner and we'd managed to get the ball and Matoma was running up the pitch. And I think about three or four West Ham players just streamed past him to get back into their defensive shape. They are such a well-drilled team, and it worked. They made it very, very difficult for us to play our game. And I wouldn't say that West Ham dominated us. I wouldn't say that they rinsed us. I wouldn't say they obliterated us. But what they did have was a fantastic game plan, and they worked it very, very well. The first half was unfortunately quite a slow half. We didn't create too much. There was a moment, as I say, Ferguson on the turn very quickly. Areola made a mess of a bit of a high ball, but no one was there to really sort of capitalize on that. The only other sort of thing that I think, unless anyone wants to chip in, worthy of note that happened in that was about when Big Bart punched the ball away from a Ward-Prowse free kick and connected with Socek, who ended up having to leave the field. Apart from that, I thought the first half was just a really disappointing from us. It was very slow. Dagan, what was your sort of view on the Brighton tactics in that first half? Do you think, as I do, that it was just a bit too slow to really cause West Ham any real problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had that one 10-minute stretch, as you alluded to earlier, where we moved the ball quickly. And then after the goal, we sort of bounced back again and showed some fire. I hate to harp on this, but I feel like it's more personnel. There's just a lacking punch in the attack when, the defense is packed in and Welbeck is a central player in that attack. Gross is in the midfield. He's not going to puncture the defense. Gilmore is in the midfield. He's not one to really puncture the defense. There was just no one out there to break anything down. I've been around a year. I hate to question, managers, even Pep today. It looked like for the most part, he had gotten it wrong by sitting Foden. I mean, they did eventually get a goal, but it came from an absolutely pristine, placed pass from Grealish to, and then having a 6'4" guy that can, sky over everybody to head the ball in. We don't have one of those. Ferguson's what, 6'1" maybe, and he can get off the ground a little bit, but maybe not quite as Haaland can. Maybe he will be in a couple of years, right? That will probably improve. But there just wasn't much space to be had, and I don't know that that's a tactical issue as much as it's a personnel one. Because, you know, yes, we could move the ball quicker. And yes, when we did, we created some chances, but I don't think anybody would argue we had lots of great chances out there. We had some good chances, but there are none that I thought were just absolutely nailed on. You've got to finish that in a way that, you know, Pedro's miss was the first, you know, few minutes of the first game, where he pushed that one wide of the post. Like, we didn't have any opportunities that looked easy like that. I know I'm being a bit curmudgeonly. I just think it boils down to, you know, defensively, we can't have Gross and Milner on the pitch at the same time unless Gross is playing in a very advanced position. I don't think we can have Welbeck out there with those guys. I do want to highlight this, and I know I'm filibustering here a little bit, but if you look back at the Everton game last year, it's a very similar setup. Though we did have our usual midfield duo playing, we had Gross at right back, trailing plays. We had Webster at right center back, who was a part of each of the first three goals for Everton. The second, as I said, very similar. The first, Dunk stabbed in, and then Doucouré came streaking down the pitch, and Webster left him completely unmarked, got turned around backwards, and Doucouré was the only runner. He was the only runner, and Webster somehow missed him. So again, I'm piling on. And again, Welbeck was an attack in that game, and he was paired with Undav. And we had, you know, Bonanotte started that game. Sally was resting and then came on late in the game in which he was injured. I mean, foot speed matters. And I think especially in the style of play that we have, foot speed matters. And we just did not have enough of it for a counterattacking opponent yesterday. You know, easy to second guess, easy to have hindsight. But when we saw the team sheet, my reaction was not those two guys again, because we've been vulnerable to the counter against Luton and Wolves, and it bit us this time.
We will talk about the team balance a little bit later. But no, very what points well made, Dagan. Thank you. And just coming off that, Sony, then, again, we've just talked about it, you know, a pretty lackluster first half from us. Some personnel that you're thinking, should they be on the pitch? Because there's no penetration. Were you surprised then when the team came out after halftime and there being no changes?
Dude, yes. I was so confused. I was hanging out with some of the DMV goals yesterday at a bar that's near my house, and we all were expecting some changes to be made. I even put a poll on Twitter, and I was like, are we going to make some changes? Do you think we're going to make some changes? And overwhelmingly, we all said yes. We're like, we're going to see some changes at the second half. The quicker that we make the changes, the more scoring that we can do. Maybe we're just not gelling properly. As soon as we came back out, it was the same people all over again. And that's when I knew we were toast. And normally, I'm pretty optimistic about these things. You know, when they all came out, I'm like, okay, maybe he talked some sense into them. Maybe they're in the wrong mindset. Like, maybe they just needed to get their stuff together, right? But then when it started going again, I could just tell that none of whatever was said in the locker room stuck, because they just kept doing the same thing, you know? But I was expecting a couple of different switches before the second half to maybe like kick it into gear, or really just tell those guys, like, you're not doing well enough. Let's sub some other people in, so, you know, maybe we can score. I guess we just didn't want to make those changes too early. Maybe we just gave them the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, definitely some unhappy people at a bar for sure.
I wanted changes, but I wasn't surprised that we didn't make any. I think I said as much on the group chat last night as well. I wasn't surprised that we saw the same team come out, because as you say, Sony, I genuinely think Roberto De Zerbi would have given them the benefit of the doubt and said, look, that wasn't good enough. Go out there and do it better. And for the first 5-10 minutes, Joe, it looked like, you know, the team, you know, because they had started moving the ball a lot quicker. You know, Ferguson almost immediately scored. And it seemed almost like a repeat of the Wolves game, the Wolves second half, where we came out and we were sort of cooking. Areola made a great save. I said great save. I think Ferguson should have done better. That is one of those, you know, Dagan, you said it about one of those chances that you feel like you should have scored. I feel like Ferguson should have scored that. I think he headed it straight at the goalkeeper. So for me, Ferguson probably should have done better. There was a moment where I think it was Matoma blazed over the bar from a corner, I think it was. So, Joe, there were some opportunities in the early part of the second half, but Brighton were just unable to take them.
Yeah, and the frustration continued, and you can sense the frustration growing amongst the fans as well. I was sort of half optimistic because in our last two games, we've started slow. We've had an okay first half and we've got our noses in front, and then we've come out after the second half and absolutely killed the game. And it's a different kettle of fish when it's you're 1-0 down. I was happy to see that we came out with a little bit more intensity. It's just a shame that it didn't last. With that Ferguson chance, I felt like he was really trying to angle it away from the keeper and just couldn't quite get the direction on the header that he would have liked. I actually thought from where I was sat, I thought it hit the post. Obviously on replays, it was that Areola saved it. Had that gone in, we continue the intensity, we continue the tenacity to get our noses in front again. It's one of those games, it really is. Everyone's saying that, it was so rubbish, this, that, and the other. These little margins, if they'd gone our way, completely different game. David Moyes is spot on. And I know I brought up the comment earlier, but he is absolutely spot on. And Dagan, you said it as well. That game's played on a different day. Those chances go in, completely different game. But that's the Premier League. If you don't take these chances when they're presented to you, you will get punished. And boy, did we get punished.
We did. But before we get on to the punishment, we need to talk about something else. And I'm going to preface this by saying that we did not lose because of the referee. We did not lose because of VAR. But we have to talk about the VAR and the referee, because there were a few moments in the second half where Brighton had some penalty calls that many fans are questioning. And I think we have to discuss that. I think the biggest penalty call that we had, Dagan, was when Purvis Estupiñán got barged into. I can't remember which West Ham player it was.
Paqueta,
thank you. He barged into what appeared to be the back of Purvis Estupiñán, who goes down. Now, this is where I start to get a bit frustrated, because the referee does his, which is very, characteristic of this particular referee, starts to do his wagging finger, which I'll come back to in a minute. So no penalty. But because of the wagging finger, I believe, and I'm more than happy for you guys here or people down in the comments to disagree with me, but I think as soon as this happens, VAR will not overrule it. And it just so happens that this week there has been some controversial comments made by a particular referee about not wanting to make their friends on the field look bad. So for me, as soon as the referee does that, VAR, for the audio listeners, I'm wagging my finger. As soon as the referee wags his finger, VAR will never intervene, because they aren't going to want to make their on-field referee look a bit silly. So, Dagan, my question to you, my friend, is this. Firstly, do you think it was a penalty? And do you think that, based on what we saw later in the game between Lewis Dunk and Mikel Antonio, that the consistency just isn't there?
Well, I think that play on the call on Dunk was earlier in the game. So the precedent had been set that a shoulder-to-shoulder tackle trailing from behind, and in Dunk's case, that contact actually, I think, did come shoulder-to-shoulder, like side of shoulder to side of shoulder. That was a foul. Antonio, a very large man, flailed magnificently to the sideline, right? And that was a foul. That was a foul. And I thought fairly called a foul. Dunk made no play on the ball, right? It was was to essentially knock the ball out. And he bumped him. Now, I think you could argue that's legal, but I think it was a combination of the force exerted, et cetera. The referee made the judgment call, which sets a huge precedent for how the referee is going to adjudicate like challenges later in the game. So as Purvis is on that run, and people talk about going for a free ball, Purvis won. He had a touch. He touched it out in front of himself to turn the corner. He, in fact, started to turn the corner before Peck had a, again, I think attempting, and in real time, perhaps even being able to be perceived to be side shoulder to shoulder. But again, if Taylor's interpretation of shoulder to shoulder with force and a player goes down, even if it's exaggeratedly, because people said, oh, well, Purvis, you know, flailed too much, and that's why it's not a foul. Like that's not in the laws of the game. That's not in the rules that if you look, you know, too exaggerated, that they're not going to, you know, rule it a foul, because that certainly didn't happen prior. But we saw it was a foul. So Taylor has given his impression of what this shoulder-to-shoulder rule means, how much force can or can't be used. The two were not adjudicated the same. So the difference is it was us, and it was in the box. And again, my understanding of fouls is it doesn't matter. A foul is a foul. If it's in the box, it's a penalty. But you don't change the definition of what is a foul or isn't a foul because it would be a penalty if you do blow the whistle. Again, not according to the rules, as I've read them. But we know how rules are interpreted by officials are different. I think you make a great point about the finger wag. But on review, and it's amazing, we have this system where you can actually slow it down and look and see if the presumption was side shoulder contact. The review made it abundantly clear, as there are multiple angles, that Paqueta's shoulder made contact with Purvis's shoulder in the rear of his shoulder. And as he followed through, his elbow hits him in the small of his lower back, which is a part of what created the flailing action that you saw. If you get hit by another person while running fast and they're running fast in the small of your lower back, you will flail out. Purvis's reaction was actually pretty consistent with the kind of hit that he took. Again, in real time to the referee, I understand how he could have interpreted it as shoulder-to-shoulder contact. And had he ruled previously on shoulder-to-shoulder contact that was okay, I wouldn't be upset, and I wouldn't say it was a penalty. But based on the fact that he had ruled it that way before, he should have called it a penalty. And based on the fact that we have the system that can review, VAR should have absolutely stepped in. But you're right, because it didn't want to embarrass his buddy who waved his finger, no, 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 it wasn't a penalty. We get nothing. And to me, it's inexcusable. They have to fix it. They have to make it transparent. We ought to be able to hear what's said. We ought to be able to hear what's said. It's in other sports. It's in other leagues. This is supposedly the best league in the world, and we're not hearing it, and it's unacceptable. It's a joke. And you cannot convince me that the decisions that Man United has benefited from, there's not something happening more than just, I want to protect my buddies. It's, I want to protect the product. That's it. Period.
I like it when Dagan gets angry. No, spot on, my friend. I mean, yeah, you make a really good point. Rashford's penalty, and that's a penalty, but getting barged into the back of isn't. It's just ridiculous. And as we say, the thing.
Can I ask people to, when they watch that back, if they're convinced that it's not a penalty, watch the second angle. Watch that second angle. That is the only one that tells me that's a penalty, because you see Paqueta look at Estupiñán very, very briefly and then forcefully hit his shoulder into the back of Purvis Estupiñán.
Yeah.
Shoulder, absolutely fine. If you outmuscle your opponent, whatever. I don't care. But if you forcefully barge them, nah, that's a foul.
And while I'm on a mini tirade, can I just hop in for a second on Paqueta? Can I just hop in? Because that guy's a cheat. He's a cheat.
Screw that guy, bro. Screw that guy.
The fake flail where he, you know, simulated contact to his face. Speaking of things the league needs to get right, like, they need to be able to review these fake, you know, head flails where there's no head contact.
There's
like,
a reason.
That should be an after the match red, he should be suspended. Like, you've got to take that out of the game because it's awful. It is absolutely awful. And it, frankly, like, I'm a person that came late to soccer, right? Football, in part because it was sort of laughed at as like, oh, they just flop around on the ground and it's a joke. And I'm like, I've come to appreciate a lot about the game. I don't appreciate that. It's embarrassing. And it needs to be addressed. And again, it would be so easy to go and look and see like, oh, that guy acted like he was hit in the face and there was absolutely no contact. I don't mind exaggerating contact. That doesn't bother me. I get it. Sometimes you have to do it to draw a foul. But simulating contact, I think, is different than exaggerating contact. One is you know, I think within what's accepted in sport. The other is just cheating. You are just attempting to cheat, period. Which it seems he has no problem doing since he was willing to, you know, be a part of, I guess this all has to be worked out, but it seems like he took an intentional yellow card to win some bets for some friends.
All I'll say is, yeah, as you say, Dagan, there is a reason his move to Manchester City is not on anymore. That's all I'll say.
Absolutely. It's just, yeah, you're right. I think, you know, I don't want to, you know, prolong the point too much, but what is the point in VAR if it's not going to, you know, do these things? That should have been Mr. Referee, simulation of contact, go and book him.
You know, I'm really surprised that after that article came out, they didn't stop a game for a weekend, reevaluated what was discussed, and then make some over changes, because that right there is like damning evidence that we know that it's not up to its full potential. Like, if you
because
want
that would
to
be admitting that they're wrong, Sony. That's why
I know that.
Admitting that it's wrong.
Right. But here's the thing, right? You want to protect the integrity of the game. You want to keep your status as like the best league in the world, and you want to keep attracting players and spectators alike. How are you supposed to do all of that if you're just going to let people admit like, oh yeah, we fake, like, you know, we don't call these things because we don't want to make our friends look stupid. Bro, where's the integrity? There is no integrity. This is insane to me. And I've only been in the sport for like, what, a year now? That is insane. That would not fly out here in the States. Like, there's no way.
It's because you're used to decent televisual referees. Me and Joe talk about it all the time. In rugby union, it is so, so good. And in the biggest sport in the world, in the best league in the world, it's awful. Joe, we have to talk very briefly about the second penalty that everyone's talking about, the handball. For me, it's not a penalty. It's very clear in the rules. Yes, it hits his hand, but the trailing hand, as Purvis crosses the ball in, it's going down onto the floor to, you know, obviously cushion that motion. But obviously fans are pointing to the Lewis dunk penalty given against Luton. So just very quickly, Joe, your thoughts on that, please.
It's in no way similar to the Lewis dunk penalty. I can see half reasons as to why the Lewis dunk one's given, as much as I don't really think it should have been a penalty. I can half understand it, right? The coup foul one, it's not a penalty. Get over it.
I think that's all that really needs to be said there. It wasn't a penalty. I think we can feel rightfully aggrieved that Purvis wasn't given a penalty. However, that handball one and the Matoma one, no, not for me. Unfortunately, though, we do then have to move on to the floodgates sort of opening. Dagan, you've already briefly talked about the second goal where, you know, Benrahma comes down on the left. Absolutely no pressure whatsoever as he waits for support. Bowen, you know, he's bombing down on the right. Crosses in, he gets beyond Estupiñán. He gets beyond Estupiñán, and they get the second. Poor defending, poor defending.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's not wanting to get blown by, because you know Webster's left on an island. I'll say this: obviously it's disappointing. Suchek getting knocked out by Verbruggen may have been a blessing in disguise for West Ham because it allowed them to bring on an extra attacker in Benrahma who could do some damage on the counterattack. And I thought that just increased the likelihood that they would score more having him out there. I was not thrilled, right? It maybe weakened them in defense a little bit, losing Suchek, who's he's a bigger guy. But I thought it really maybe helped them going the other way. And in that moment, Benrahma was creative and effective and, you know, found the weakness, found the opening. And there were There were openings.
And once again, it was down our right-hand side. You know, Webster coming across to cover for a right-back that isn't there. But we don't need a right-back, do we? Third goal then, Sony. Once again, poor Adam Webster getting involved. It was a goal kick. Antonio then swivels, leaves Webster for dead, and he fires it into the corner. Poor defending again, Sony. Poor Adam Webster. He had a poor game.
Hat trick for Webster, yes.
Oh, no, that's not what we needed. That's the wrong kind of hat trick. I don't have any words to describe how I felt about yesterday's game, in all honesty. Shout out to the Froze that I was drinking in my hand yesterday. Otherwise, I would have been even angrier. So it was kind of keeping me, like, chilled out and all. But just, I don't even know. Like, why? Why? I just want to know why. Like, did you have a bad day before you got into work? Did you, like, do something? Did someone upset you? Like, what made you not want to perform at your best today and then allow three goals? Because, like, I understand. Just, yeah. Oh, God. I don't have words, bro. I don't have words. I don't have words. I'm just gonna, nope, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean,
that was the most perfect way of talking about the third goal yesterday.
Yeah, it was just embarrassing. It was just embarrassing. But again, it comes down to West Ham's very good game plan. All three goals exploiting defensive weakness, all from two of those goals from the same side, but all three involving the same player. And, you know, credit to David Moyes and West Ham for exploiting that, because it worked a treat and it worked three times. And on another day, as Joe says, we could have won that game. But on another day, you know, they hit the crossbar twice. You know, they could have blown us away even more than they did. But we did eventually score, Dagan. It was Pascal Gross who did eventually score for us. And in doing so, he became the our Premier League top scorer of all time, with a drive from 20 yards. Is it a bit of just a consolation goal for you?
I mean, look, there was a moment where we had a chance to maybe, you know, creep back into the game, right? It felt like, okay, if we can get one more back here, maybe we're back in this thing. And you know, we're threatening enough offense and a potent enough offense that we could score three goals in that amount of time. We sure did last week. So it didn't feel over before that, and it certainly didn't feel over after that. And you know, again, that was Gross fighting the ball in a more advanced position, where he could create an opportunity. And I think that's where Gross is at his best, when he's in that position. It's just tough because we effectively have to start him at the 10 for him to be in that position. And so you would certainly want, you know, a more electric player to be paired with him if that was the choice. So I wonder if we'll ever see a Gross and João Pedro 9-10 tandem. That would intrigue me.
It would. And that leads us very nicely on to what I call the Gross conundrum. And this is, we'll come to Joe first on this, but I want everyone's opinion on this, and including you listeners and viewers as well. I will preface this by saying, I know I've joked about Pascal Gross being in my worst Albion 11 at right back and all that sort of stuff. And I know I've joked about that, but I genuinely think Pascal Gross is one of the best players Brighton have ever had. You know, that, you know, the value we've had on Pascal Gross is insane. I rate him as a footballer. I really, really do. However, it worries me somewhat that we always need to try and shoehorn Pascal Gross into the starting 11 somewhere. It doesn't seem to matter what position, as long as he's on the pitch. And my question to you guys on this is this: does the fact that Pascal Gross has to start hold us back? So, Joe, I'm going to come to you on this one first.
Yeah, so you asked the question in the group chat, and I wanted to hold my comments back for this exact moment. The message I wrote back was, the fact of what Pascal gives us are there to see in black and white. At 3-0 down, the players have nothing to lose and we're pushing in a more advanced areas of the pitch where Pascal, where we say that he thrives. Pascal Gross, utilised correctly, is the best player on the pitch, in my opinion. Roberto De Zerbi has used him at right back effectively against the correct opposition, and he's also been utilised correctly in more advanced roles. Saying this, he is not undroppable. Lewis Dunk is not undroppable. Karu Mutoma is not undroppable. Nobody is undroppable. We're playing against the wrong opposition for Pascal Gross. Should he start? No. If we're playing against the wrong opposition for Karu Mutoma, should he start? No. So I think when we bring in that Caicedo replacement, how Pascal Gross is being utilised at the moment, we want that Caicedo replacement in the starting 11, right? So where does Pascal Gross fit? Is he a right back ahead of James Milner if we don't get a right back in? And Ciso's injured. More opportunity for Pascal Gross to play in that position that we say he could thrive and has thrived before. I absolutely get what Pascal Gross has done for this football club and I adore him. You know how much I love him. But he's not undroppable.
I think I'm starting to worry that he is, though, Joe. And that's the point. We as fans go, yeah, he's not undroppable because we know he's got flaws in his game. But I'm sure I should have got the stats for this. I wonder how many games under Roberto De Zerbi, when he's been available, he's played. Because I would be willing to bet it's the majority of them. But my worry isn't him in an advanced role, because I totally agree. I think him at the 10 works. You know, Glenn Murray famously said, you know, it was because of Pascal Gross that he scored so many Premier League goals. My worry is that we're shoehorning him into positions like right back and at 8 that he can't play in just so he's on the pitch.
But that's my point, Tom. When that Caicedo replacement comes in, where does he go?
But then my point is that he'll probably end up being started at right back.
Then if he's playing against the correct opposition to play at right back, then fantastic, because we know
he's got qualities there. Because this is the problem. We've just spent the whole of this podcast bemoaning the space utilized on our right because we don't have a right back.
What I'm saying is
Luton did it. Newcastle will do it. We need a right back and we can't rely on playing out of position players in a position that is very specialist, because you need to be able to bomb forward and get back. That's why Tarik Lamptey isn't the best right back. Very good wing back, but he doesn't have the same defensive nous as someone like Purvis, who almost seems to know what's going to happen before it does. Very good at going forward. And Veltman's the polar opposite. Very good at defending, but going forward, he hasn't got that. And I totally agree that Purvis is maybe one in a million. But I worry that because it's this, we need to get Pascal in the team somewhere, we'll find a space or we'll just chuck him in at right back. We don't need a right back. I worry that that's a risky move going forward, because as soon as we've come up against some really good wingers, our right-hand side has been targeted and we have conceded 3 goals. That's my concern. He's a fantastic player. I don't think he should start ahead of João Pedro at 10, because he's not.
No, that was my point, though. I was saying no one's undroppable. Not one person in this team.
No, I know that you know that, Joe. No, we know that. But it's not about us. It's about what De Zerbi thinks. And I worry that De Zerbi thinks that as long as he's on the pitch somewhere, good.
He's a good enough tactician to not to think that, just chuck him there. He'll be all right. What? In my opinion, I don't think he's that silly to just be like, we'll just let Pascal do whatever. I think he's got more of a plan as to what he wants Pascal Gross to do, rather than just saying, just put him there.
I just want to be sure I'm clear on dropped and droppable. Because you guys used the phrase earlier that, you know, Steele was dropped for Bruggen. But, I mean, to me, we sort of knew they were rotating. Like, it wasn't necessarily a preferential choice. Are those things like used interchangeably? Like, is any drop a drop?
Yeah.
Yeah. Drop can be used as we're dropping you because you're not good enough, or you're getting dropped because somebody else is in for this game.
Okay. So like, because like obviously we have so many games we have to rotate. Like, so that's a given. But I can't, like, I can imagine a lot of instances where playing Gross in some of the positions that he typically plays would jeopardize us more than playing someone else there. I don't think we can say at any point playing Dunk at center back where he plays, either right or left, would jeopardize us more than playing someone else. Like, is that fair? Like, Dunk to me is pretty locked on. I would say the same is pretty true of Matoma. Like, I can't imagine a scenario where, you know, we're at great risk or our attack is weaker unless he's tired and being rotated for fatigue reasons, where we wouldn't want Matoma out there. But like, I can envision a lot of places where the most fit, the most, you know, talented Gross shouldn't be out there. And if, I mean, I take your point that everyone is droppable, but I think you can make a case that there are a lot of games where if he's put in the wrong position, he is the weakest link on the field. And I think there are times, you're right, Joe, when in the right position against the right opposition, he might be our best or most important player. But I think as we aspire to greater heights, if we've got him out there and we know his speed is an issue, and it is for counterattacking teams, especially if he's playing further back, right? Can we concede as a group maybe that we can't have both Gross and James Milner out there together as in the back seven? Is that a fair statement?
I think it is more than fair. I think we saw Milner struggle somewhat yesterday. And again, it goes back to that. We don't have a right back.
Do I have a question for you? And I have a question for you guys too, who were watching. And I had this conversation with a buddy. It looks like there's some tension between Gross and Milner. Have you guys seen that? Their discourse, there was an exchange yesterday where Milner should have run onto a ball, sort of overlapping from right back into Solly's place, and he didn't go on a run, and the pass kind of went out of bounds. And he and Gross kind of had a moment where they were animated. And the commentator noted Gross is telling Milner what he ought to be doing. And it did not look like Milner took kindly to being told what he ought to be doing by Pascal Gross. And I just wonder if they're going to find a lot of frustration in playing together because they're used to people covering for them, and they're not able to cover for each other.
I'm going to say that's a gelling situation.
So my question was, Joe, did you see it? And it looked like from your face already you told me no.
I mean, I haven't seen it, but I feel like it's more of a gelling situation than it is a they-don't-get-along situation. It's more of just like, in the moment, can you work out your problems on the fly, you know, because we kind of consider them as veterans towards the younger players, you know, like you have James Milner, who's been on a bunch of other teams. You have Pascal Gross, who's kind of been like a figure for the team. So you have two people with two strong personalities on the field trying to make decisions. How, I think the problem for me is, can they gel properly at the same time? If we're going to run into that issue, because we can't have that issue at all.
It's probably one of those things as well. I mean, I don't know at what point it happened in the game. If it's like a case of it when it happened at 0-0, that's one thing. If it's like 1-0, 2-0, 3-0, obviously that's when, you know, people start getting frustrated with each other. I just want to wrap this little section up here by just saying, you know, in my opinion, I just feel like the team is very unbalanced, and I'm not necessarily I don't want to come across as that I'm attacking Gross. It's just that because in the past we've just tried to shoehorn him in, that I start to get a bit sort of, is he the best option? For me, against West Ham, I would have played De Hood, and I would have played Veltman. I wouldn't have had Gross or Milner on the pitch.
Can I say something about that really quick? Because I wanted to kind of touch up on the subject at hand. I kind of want to go with Joe's whole thing where he's like, nobody on the pitch, nobody on the team is undroppable. That's very true. Anybody can be dropped. and be replaced with a person who's better fit for the team. I think it was just more of we just didn't really think about it too hard. We were making the lineups and stuff. I don't think we were thinking ahead, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like West Ham saw our team play the last two weekends and went, okay, cool, this is probably what they're going to do. This is how we counterattack it. I don't think we built it personally to West Ham. That's one. Two, do I think Gross is shoehorned into every lineup? No, I don't think so. I think maybe it's just me not paying attention to the lineups as much. Maybe I think it's just a coincidence. I don't know, but I haven't seen many bad performances by him enough to say like, oh, you know, like that was a bad life choice or whatever. But I don't think so, actually. I don't think that is the case. I don't know.
It's all good for us to, when it goes wrong, alarm bells ring. We're like, oh my God, how do we fix this? What do we do? When the fact of the matter is, yes, maybe Pascal didn't have a great game. Maybe Milner didn't have a great game. Maybe Webster didn't have a great game. But it's one game, right? These problems keep happening. Absolutely, the alarm bells ring. But it's one game.
But it's not one game, Joe. It's just one loss. The same tactic has been employed by Luton and by Wolves and by West Ham. That's the point. It's like they say, you learn more when you lose than when you win. So I rate Pascal Gross, but it's more of a wider spectrum. I really hope that James Milner isn't just going to be our starting right back, because he's not a right back. I know he can play a right back, but he's not a right back. I get that my opinion means absolutely nothing to Roberto De Zerbi, and it's what he thinks counts. And I know he wants a left back more than a right back. That's cool. That's what he wants. But for me, right back should be a higher priority, in my opinion. Anyway,
I'm unbelievably shocked that Joel Veltman hasn't seen more of the team, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think he is the most capable right back we have.
Agreed.
I know you're going to say, oh, he's not a right back. I understand that. But he is the most capable right back.
Yeah, and that's what I mean when I say about our team being unbalanced. I would rather Veltman start right back than Milner. Personally, I think if you're going to go for our strongest 11 with the people that we have, Veltman takes that right hand, like fullback position. Again, let me know your thoughts in the comment section down below about what you think about the Gross conundrum. It's not about how good of a player Pascal is. It's not about how underrated or overrated he is. It's more about, are we seeing him just shoved in the first team when there are perhaps better options available? Let me know your thoughts in the comment section down below. We did have a little bit of an aristeia at the end. For those of you who don't know, aristeia is a Greek word that means like your blood is boiling and you're going full throttle at it. But the game ended 3-1. And as I say, our first defeat of the season. Pretty difficult one to take. I think very disappointed Brighton fans, a lot of angry Brighton fans as well. But, you know, we move. So let's talk about our next game, which is against Newcastle, who had a fantastic season last year. Last time we played them at home, it was a 0-0 draw. Eddie Howe just got his team to sit back and soak up a lot of pressure. But if it wasn't for Nick Pope, I think we would have won that game. But at St. James's Park, I think it's fair to say we got absolutely played off the park. So it's going to be a tough game, I think, next weekend. Dagan, Newcastle United, a tough test for a Brighton side beaten well by West Ham.
You asking for prediction here, Tom? What are you asking me for?
I'm asking you to tell me about Newcastle, Dagan. What should we be wary of?
I mean, a much better version of what we've already seen. Newcastle does a lot of things well. They're big and physical. They are fast and can counterattack. They've got a couple of striker options that can score goals. They sort of present with everything that on paper gives us problems. We absolutely have to score first. If we don't score first, I give us very little chance of winning this game. And in fact, if we don't score first, I would predict a loss of some magnitude against this team. I have to say of this game, before I make a prediction on Newcastle, this past game, because I've been very negative. The reality is, if that Gilmore shot goes in, it's a different game. The reality is, if that's a penalty called on purpose, it's a very different game. We convert the penalty into 1-1. If down 3-1, Ings doesn't make an unbelievable play, maybe the defensive play of Ings' life to get in and stop that excellent dunk header off the line. We get to 3-2. And again, maybe it's a different game. But the fact of the matter is those things didn't happen. You have to take your chances. We had 17 corners and got virtually nothing out of them. This Newcastle game is going to come down to whether we'll take our chances. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it until I see the team sheet, whether I think we have a chance. If we haven't learned our lessons and we trot out Welbeck and we trot out Milner and Gross together again, I would say my prediction for this game would be a 3-1 loss. Just like the one we just saw.
Sony, Dagan mentioned there about changes. What changes would you make to the team that started against West Ham to go and face Newcastle?
I'm going to go with the same thing Dagan said. We don't want Milner and Gross together. Definitely, please do not take out Welbeck out there. No, absolutely not. And then I think we just need to sit down our favorite guy today, Adam Webster. We just got to sit him down and be like, yo, bro, you got to chill. We got to, I love you and all, bro, but you got to sit this one out, you know? And I think if I read this right on Twitter, RDZ was looking forward to Newcastle anyway. So if anything, he's already getting ready for that. And maybe this was the game that was like a test to see who could go on to the Newcastle game. Because obviously that's important. Newcastle's going to the Champions League. You know, maybe that's what he was trying to do. But again, if we get our stuff together and we play our cards right and everybody's in the place that they're supposed to be, right? We'll win. Well, we set the tone. We put in one goal. We set the tone. We go from there, right? If we don't learn from our mistakes this weekend and we trot out the same people who caused us a bunch of problems to begin with, we're going to lose. And we're going to lose spectacularly. We're going to probably be laughed at all weekend. So for me, I'm going to go, I don't know. I'm very indecisive of this. I'm actually going to put this at a tie at like 2-2. I feel like we will absolutely bring on the heat, but they might respond with the same way, especially with the way how they've been playing lately. Yeah, I'm just going to put it at 2-2.
Interesting. Now, before I come to you, Joe, Dagan, just want to have a quick word on the defense for next week.
I was just going to say, and Joe, I hope I don't steal your thunder here, but I think Veltman, I didn't say this, but I think Veltman has to start. I think Dunk has to start. Stupinan has to start. I'd love to see Dunk at right center back paired with either Igor or Van Hecke. And I guess if it's Van Hecke, then Dunk would slide over to the left. But I kind of want to see Igor. I mean, Joe, you mentioned earlier, right? You pay nearly $20 million for a guy. You probably want to give him some time. I hope he's gotten his feet underneath of him and is ready to step in. I feel like in a game where physicality is going to be at a premium, a guy who's, you know, built like a truck might be worth a shot in this game. If nothing else, he will. It'd be fun to see him go toe to toe with Joe Linton.
That guy's going to run over people. Like, have you seen him? He's going to run over people. I'm excited for that.
Brother is swole, as the Ute of today say. Joe, over to you then, my friend. What changes, if any, would you make? And what would your score prediction be, please?
Igor is in for me, 100%. Last season, we saw a defensive pairing of Lewis Dunk and Levi Colwill work so spectacularly well for the way that Roberto De Zerbi wants to play football. And Igor is the closest thing that we have in this squad to Levi Colwill from the highlight reel that I've seen of him. I can't claim that I'm an Igor expert. I can't claim I'm a Fiorentina expert and that I've watched loads of their games. But from what I've seen, he has to be in there for the way we want to play football. And he's got the pace and the strength and the capabilities of covering when the counter-attack is happening. Yeah, for me, that has to happen. Veltman's got to be in. I agree with you, Dagan. We just need a more solid back four for those counter-attacking opportunities that Newcastle will 100% get. They are a scary team on the counter. They are a scary team whatever happens in the game. They will hurt us. They have every single bullet of ammunition that they could possibly shoot at us, and we have to be ready for it. Roberto De Zerbi will have them ready for it. There's been a lot of negativity on this podcast, but I think it's worth remembering that when we lost spectacularly to Everton, the reaction after that was just as spectacular. So let's see how these boys respond. And let's hope that we're going, I think it's the international break afterwards, going into the international break with the spring in our step. But I will say to people, do not be defeatist and down in the dumps if we lose this game. Because we've just played a West Ham team with a spring in their step after beating Chelsea, after winning a European competition. Absolutely, they're going to be stronger and a little bit more buoyant this season. And that's exactly what we saw. And it's about bloody time that they beat us in the Premier League, by the way. And Newcastle, if we lose to them, they are an unbelievable side. Eddie Howe has got them playing some fantastic football. They are so dangerous. They are relentless. So if that happens, so what? Let's move on to the next one. Let's get excited for the Champions League, I wish. Let's get excited for the Europa League. And just take the season as it comes. It's going to be tough. This season will be tough. We've had our fun of saying, oh, we're top of the league. That's not going to happen. It's going to be a really tough, long season. Let's just stick with the boys.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there, Joe, in regards to the bounce-back ability of Roberto De Zerbi's side. We saw it after the Nottingham Forest game, we saw it after the Everton game. We do have a habit of bouncing back quite well. So let's cross our fingers and hope that we do that against Newcastle, because Newcastle are a team that can hurt you. For what it's worth, I'd keep Bart in goal, because I thought, you know, that hasn't done anything warranting being dropped. Then, yeah, back four, Purvis, Igor, Dunk and Veltman. I'd bring Dahoud in. I want to see more of Dahoud. And maybe a Dahoud-Gilmore pairing might be a bit too flary and not enough defensive capability. But I think Dahoud looks a shade quicker than Gross or Milner, and maybe just be able to cover back, just to get a body there as much as anything. And then I want to see João Pedro. I want to see him from the start in the 10. And then Ferguson, March, Matoma, pretty much. So, yeah, it'll be an interesting one, because it will, as you say, Newcastle can either do a West Ham or an Everton, sit back and just hit us on the counter, or, you know, like many of the big teams, want to come to the Amex and play football their way, because that's what big teams want to do. So it'll be very
worth noting for the audio listeners, Tom was saying those in quotation marks.
Yeah, I don't like this whole idea of big teams. I think it's pathetic and immature. But anyway, let us know your thoughts in the comments section down below. What do you make of the West Ham Brighton score? What would you do ahead of Newcastle? Who would you bring in? Who would you drop down to the bench? And of course, let us know your score predictions as well. All that needs to be said now then is, don't forget to like, share and subscribe for more content if you haven't done so already. Wherever you may be, whenever you may be, keep your chin up, and we'll see you next time. Take care.